It took generations to build the Notre Dame Cathedral. Yesterday, its spire burned and fell within hours.
People couldn't believe it. We could not just believe what we were seeing.
How much of the building beneath that spire survived? I'm David Green with Steve Inskeep, and this is Up First from NPR News.
Some 2020 Democratic contenders are releasing their tax returns. One candidate said, okay, your turn.
Hey, President Trump, my wife and I just released 10 years. Please do the same.
How much money does Bernie Sanders have, and how does that affect his critique of the wealthy?
And public health officials warn of a significant rise in measles cases. What is driving the resurgence of a virus that seemed wiped out in the U.S. 2 decades ago? Stay with us. We have the news you need to start your day.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in issues including depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit BetterHelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Sound there of Parisians gathering last night on the banks of the Seine River, singing hymns, praying. Across the water, fire and smoke rose from Notre Dame Cathedral.
This house of worship was begun in the Middle Ages, took centuries to build. Nobody who began the work could have lived to see it complete. It survived many wars, and it lasted long enough to appear in the photos of giddy tourists who came from nations that did not even exist when the cathedral was started. Though fire collapsed its spire yesterday, the crews who put out the flames discovered parts of the cathedral still standing.
Parce que Notre-Dame de Paris, c'est notre histoire.
French President Emmanuel Macron there saying that the cathedral is part of the country's history, its literature, and its psyche.
And let's turn to NPR's correspondent based in Paris, Eleanor Beardsley, who joins us this morning and watched all of this unfold yesterday. Eleanor, just give me the scene. What does it feel like in the city this morning?
Somber, David. I've been talking to people. They're sad. Some people are crying. I mean, it's just, you hear the traffic behind, but not much noise. Hundreds, thousands of people come out. We're just out on the sidewalk right beside the river looking at Notre Dame, and the spire is no more. There's the scaffolding up, and there's charred stones coming out of a stained glass window that's gone, but it's still here. The two front bell towers are still here. The cathedral is still here.
So you're out there right now.
That's right. I'm out here right now, yeah.
What happened? I mean, is anyone talking about what caused this fire?
Yes, they are. It's very interesting. So, as you know, they were doing a renovation on the roof of the cathedral, very expensive renovation, and just under that spire that fell, on an area that's known as the forest, because it is 100 yards of just sheer timber that is centuries old and has been waxed and polished, and that's where the fire, they believe, began. And so once it started, it was almost impossible to put out, and firefighters at that point had to make a decision, and they decided to try to save the front two bell towers, the facade, rather than the roof, because it was impossible.
So they had to make some really difficult decisions. Were they able to save, I don't know how to even put this, like what's most important? I mean, have they saved some of the art, the relics, what matters most?
Well, they have. They've saved, there's a crown of thorns. I'm not exactly sure if it's thought to be Jesus' crown of thorns, but it's a crown of thorns that's very valuable. And they've saved St. Louis' tunic and many other paintings and things which are being housed next door in the Hotel de Ville. But they're still trying to get things out this morning, and the head of the police fire chief said that they're making sure the building is secure so that the rest of the artwork can get out, can be brought out. But meanwhile, they've shown footage for the first time on TV of the interior of the church, and it's shocking. There's piles of smoking rubble. The roof is open to the sky, and it's shocking.
So I know you're out there this morning with Parisians who are just reflecting on all of this. What are people saying in terms of the meaning of what happened yesterday?
Well, they feel like 1,000 years of history just went up in a couple hours, and everyone talks about how much this church means to them, means to France, but not just to France, to world humanity. I spoke with a tourist from South Africa, Tito Foster, and he says he's so happy that he went inside Notre Dame on Sunday and got to see it. Here's what he told me.
It was quite amazing to be inside on Sunday, and then last night we came back while it was burning, and now for the after effect. We were actually walking around here this morning just saying how somber the mood is. It's almost quiet as you come into the area in comparison to the other areas in Paris. Mm.
I mean, Eleanor, you've lived in this city for so many years. You must be feeling something very powerful.
I am. I woke up this morning and I thought Notre Dame is not with us as she was anymore. The church turned 850 in 2013. The church got the bells replaced. They all had their own names and they rung for the first time. And there was just hundreds of thousands of people out for that. It's like a friend. I've talked to other Parisians who say, I walk by it every day and I don't notice her much, but she's so beautiful and it's such a loss. So people are feeling this very deeply.
All right, but fortunate, I guess, that it looks like it can be rebuilt, that the destruction was not complete in any way.
Absolutely. President Macron said the structure is here and there is hope. He said we've improved this cathedral over the centuries and we're going to do it again together as a nation. And he said we're going to call on France's best talent to make this cathedral even more beautiful. But it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars and it could take, some say, as long as a decade.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome, David.
So during past presidential elections, it's been pretty standard for major party nominees to release their tax returns.
In 2016, candidate Donald Trump became the first general election candidate in more than four decades who did not keep a promise to release them. Democrats in Congress have more recently requested his taxes, citing their authority under the law, although the White House is resisting. As it's happening, 2020 presidential contenders are putting out several years of their own returns. They include, among others, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and, as of last night, Bernie Sanders and Beto O'Rourke.
And one person following all of the numbers, NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, who is with us. Hey, Domenico.
Good morning.
So anything standing out to you so far?
Well, look, when we look at these tax returns, we're looking at three things to start off with. One, income. Two, tax rate, what they pay in taxes. And three, their charitable giving. So just a few top lines from this so far. Kamala Harris's household was the highest income, and they were taxed at the highest rate. Beto O'Rourke and his wife have significant assets and investments, and according to his 2017 tax return, didn't give a whole lot to charity. And Elizabeth Warren, she was the most charitable. But a notable finding from these tax returns was what it showed about Bernie Sanders, the Vermont Independent Senators. For years and years, he's been one of the least wealthy members of Congress. But since his 2016 campaign, he was able to cash in on a book he wrote, Where We Go From Here. And he has lambasted millionaires and billionaires, as we know, for years. But guess what? After 2016, he made over $1 million in some of those years. And that was something he was asked about during a town hall on Fox News last night. Let's take a listen.
It's a bestseller, sold all over the world, and we made money. So if anyone thinks that I should apologize
for writing
a best-selling book, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it.
Well, wow. That's pretty classic Bernie Sanders. And I have to say, for a democratic socialist, that was a pretty capitalistic answer.
Huh. Should he be worried? I mean, could this come back to bite him if he has a lot of money and still has his populist message?
Well, he's also raising a ton of money from grassroots and from the base. So he clearly has a huge depth of support still from his base. And this does not look like it's derailing him whatsoever.
Okay. So who have we not heard from at this point? And is there a reason? Like, are people deciding that they don't want to release these tax returns?
Well, they're complicated, but we haven't heard from about a dozen others, like Pete Buttigieg, for example, the South Bend, Indiana mayor, Cory Booker of New Jersey. But everyone's pledging to release them soon. Booker, for example, has released previously 15 years of tax returns.
And there's this really high-profile person running for president in 2020 who we definitely haven't seen tax returns from. That's the president of the United States. Is that going? Where does that stand? And have we learned anything? I mean, we are getting some fundraising numbers from him.
Well, Democrats are certainly trying to push to get his tax returns released. Democrats on Capitol Hill have been filing formal requests, trying to get those. There's no sign that the president's going to do so at this point. He said that he's not inclined to do it. But as far as his campaign fundraising goes, he's raised $30 million, most of that from political committees, just $4 million from small donors, which stands in stark contrast with Democrats who are trying to draw a significant share from the grassroots.
Any evidence in this long battle over the president's tax returns that it's hurting him politically to keep them away from people?
Not with his base, you know, and that's, we've never seen a president who has focused more on his base to try to win re-election.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, Domenico.
You're so welcome.
And if you want to learn more about the candidates' money, their tax returns, and what they are raising for their campaigns, you can check out all the numbers if you visit NPR.org. I mean, let's look back to the year 2000. Measles was declared officially eliminated from the United States after a full year of no transmissions.
But now the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is seeing the virus return. New numbers were released yesterday, and so far, 555 cases, 555, have been reported this year alone. New York City last week declared a public health emergency. New York's Herminia Palacio, Deputy Mayor of Health and Human Services, asked parents to do more.
When you make the decision not to vaccinate your child, please understand you are also making that decision for the people around your child.
Okay, so what exactly is causing the spike in cases? NPR Global Health Correspondent Michaeline Duclef has been tracking all of this. Hi, Michaeline.
Hello, good morning.
So put this outbreak in perspective. How bad is this?
Yeah, so 555 cases is actually about 50% more cases than we saw for the entire year last year. It's also the second biggest outbreak we've had in more than two decades.
Wow, so that's significant.
Yeah, it is significant. When the CDC also says that it's going to grow, right? This thing is getting worse. They actually, one of the health officials I talked to said that it's accelerating.
And this has been largely New York City, is that right? Or are there other spots where this is coming out?
Yeah, so about 400 of those cases, the vast majority, are linked to two outbreaks in New York, one in Brooklyn and one in Rockland County, north of the city. As you mentioned before, the city has declared a public health emergency and is actually calling for mandatory vaccinations. So adults and kids have to get vaccinated, else families could be fined. The CDC also points to outbreaks in Washington State, Michigan, New Jersey, and several parts of California.
Okay, so the big question, why? Why this surge now?
Yeah, so health officials say that really two things are working together to amplify the problem. First of all, there's actually a surge of measles around the world right now. The World Health Organization just said this week that there have been four times as many cases reported this year as there were at the same time last year. And several countries have these massive outbreaks right now with tens of thousands of cases. Just to put our 500 cases into a global perspective,
yeah.
Ukraine, Madagascar have, you know, tens of thousands of cases. There are also significant outbreaks in Israel, several countries in the European Union, and Indonesia. So the CDC thinks that more Americans are traveling to these countries and bringing them home. But then there's another problem here back at home, is that some communities here, the vaccination rates have really dropped significantly in the past few years, below the level needed to protect the whole community. And so once the virus lands here, it has more of a chance of getting a foothold and triggering an outbreak.
Well, and that's what we heard there from the deputy mayor of New York City, suggesting that parents are not just protecting their children, they're protecting other children by making a decision about vaccinations. What other advice are people giving to parents?
Yeah, so check to make sure your kids have two doses of the vaccine. You really need two doses to get the full protection. And also, if you are living in and out where the outbreak is or around it, some health officials are calling for babies to get vaccinated a little bit earlier, around 6 months instead of the typical 12 months. But really, the key is vaccination. Measles is super, super contagious, and everybody needs to be protected in order for an outbreak not to occur.
All right. NPR Global Health Correspondent Michaeline Duclef for us this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. That is up first for Tuesday, April 16th. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Join us here tomorrow. Subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts and rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts.
We appreciate you waking up with us here at NPR. Your NPR station makes Up First possible each and every morning. You can support them, and by doing so, support us. Just visit donate.npr.org/upfirst.
America has a long history of white nationalism, and its influence reaches farther than you might think.
You can go back and you can read the New York Times coverage. You can read Hitler saying, "It was America who taught us we should not open our arms equally to other nations."
This week on It's Been a Minute from NPR.